Seit mehr als 155 Jahren begleitet die Commerzbank Kundinnen und Kunden bei wichtigen finanziellen Entscheidungen. Ob sie ihr Unternehmen weiterentwickeln, ihr Vermögen strukturieren oder ihre finanzielle Zukunft planen. Gemeinsam machen wir aus ihren Ideen, Plänen und Anliegen echte Erfolgsgeschichten. Erfolg, der auf unserer langjährigen Expertise und einer vertrauensvollen Partnerschaft basiert. Erfolgsgeschichten beginnen bei der Commerzbank. Wann sprechen wir über Ihre? Mehr Infos unter commerzbank.de/Erfolgsgeschichten.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
Lock the gate!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck, buddies? What the fuck, Nicks? How's it going with you? How is it going there? What's happening with you and yours? Are you okay? Okay is good. Okay is the new good. Today I'm going to talk to Ben Mendelsohn. He's like these Australian actors. I don't know what it is about the terrain, the air. I don't know. But a lot of them are fucking great. And this guy's fucking great. You might know him from the movie Animal Kingdom. He was in The Dark Knight Rises, The King, Darkest Hour. My favorites, the ones I saw him in where I'm like, who the fuck is this guy? Was an Australian movie called Baby Teeth and Nicole Holofcener's Land of Steady Habits. And I was like, oh my God, what's up with this guy? And this thing he's in now, this series, he's playing Christian Dior in the new Apple TV Plus series, The New Look. And it's great because I had no idea about, I don't know about history. I didn't know. I mean, I kind of knew, but I guess it's not at the tip of my brain, the tip of my tongue, the Nazi occupation of France and how that might have affected the French and what was going on in France. But this is specifically around the fashion industry during the occupation with Dior and Coco Chanel, played by Juliette Binoche, who I haven't seen in a while. Have you? I guess she's around, but God damn, she was great. John Malkovich is great in this. Now, no, look, you know, when I talk about Malkovich, I'm not diminishing his amazing chops as an actor. It's just sometimes he's the only thing you can look at. He's the only thing that's pulling you in. He goes for it. But this one, in this miniseries, he's not low key per se, but he's locked into a subtler character, and it was great to see. And Mendelsohn is great. I found it not only a beautiful story about the beginnings of Dior, but a historic perspective on the occupation of France, and just shot well. And I don't know. I thought it was great. And he's going to talk about that a bit and about his career and about Australia. You know, the stuff. I know that some of you are getting tired of hearing my tour dates, but I'm going to do them because this is how I put it out in the world. I'm in Portland this Thursday, March 7th at the State Theater. I'm in Medford, Massachusetts at the Chevalier Theater on Friday, March 8th. That's just outside of Boston. It's right next to Cambridge. Providence, Rhode Island at the Strand Theater on Saturday, March 9th. Tarrytown, New York, the Tarrytown Music Hall on Sunday, March 10th. Later in March, I'm in Atlanta, Georgia at the Buckhead Theater on Friday, the 22nd. That's close to selling out. Boise, Idaho, I'm at the Egyptian Theater on Saturday, March 23rd as part of Comedy Fort at Treefort Music Fest. Madison, Wisconsin at the Barrymore Theater on Wednesday, April 3rd. Milwaukee, Wisconsin at the Turner Hall Ballroom on Thursday, April 4th. Chicago at the Vic Theater on Friday, April 5th. Minneapolis at the Pantages Theater on Saturday, April 6th. Austin, Texas at the Paramount on Thursday, April 18th, part of Moon Tower Comedy Festival. Montclair, New Jersey on Thursday, May 2nd. at the Wilmont Center, Glenside, Pennsylvania in the Philly area, Friday, May 3rd at the Keswick, and Washington, D.C. on Saturday, May 4th at the Warner Theater. WTFpod.com/tour for tickets. Ooh, man. I don't know if you saw this, but Keith Richards has done a cover of Lou Reed's I'm Waiting for My Man. Now, look, you guys know how I feel about Keith, but I struggle with a lot of this stuff because there's a lot of boomers. There's a lot of people of his age group who are artists and musicians and actors and comedians where I'm like, you know, hang it up. But I'll be honest with you, man. There's something that I just get excited. Like, I didn't care about the last Stones album, really. I mean, that Blue and Lonesome one's great. That was a few years ago. But the last regular Stones album, it's good. I'm fine. But I didn't care. And I got it. I listened to it once. Keith Richards is part of this tribute album for Lou Reed. And they did a video with Jordan on drums and Keith playing, like, all the guitars of the very basic I'm Waiting for My Man. And just the respect that Keith is affording Lou, and the fact that out of all of them, the entire arc of modern rock and roll, that Keith is the last man standing in a lot of ways, but still vital somehow, that there's still this element of Keith. I'm excited to see him. Look, I know he's old. He doesn't look the same. He's got a little pot belly now. But there's some part about the sort of earned and always present giving zero fucks of Keith Richards that is... It's an inspiration to me. He's inspirational. I mean, it's an aspiration for me to give less fucks. It seems to happen, you know, more with age. But these musicians, like, it's a whole life of being in the studio. That's your life and making things. I'm just out here, you know, yammering on about myself. And I feel like, I don't know, it's not that ship has sailed, but this is beside the point. I was thrilled to see Keith covering this song. Keith is the heart of fucking rock and roll, certainly modern rock and roll, and he goes all the way up through everybody. You know, I mean, I ended up watching that video, you know, 4 or 5 times, and then somehow on YouTube, I got back to some video there. It's like the Rolling Stones live at the Marquee Club in 1971 doing Midnight Rambler, which is really probably my favorite Stones song in some ways. And there's just something about the simplicity, the rawness, the impulsiveness, the sloppiness of Keith Richards. It's just the heart of the whole fucking thing. You know, that freedom of fuck you with effortless fuck you and effortless zero fucks that's it, man. And that Midnight Rambler is crazy. I watched it like 4 or 5 times. I played along with it. It's a simple song, but there's just the way he constructs simple riffs where it's like this lifetime mystery. I riffed a little bit on I'm Waiting for My Man at the end of this podcast. And there's a little, I missed it a few times, the way he pulls off of that C note on the G chord. I got it a few times, but like these things, they take a lifetime sometimes, or hours at least in the studio if you're a musician, to just nail it. But I don't know, man. It's just there's something about Keith that, you know, has been in my heart forever. And that's just not music. I'm happy. I'm happy to see him like my grandfather. I'm like, look, here he comes. Look at him. But he's doing a song about dope. So it's got all that extra added menace. But the fact that he's the heart of it, the heart of raunchy, fucking raw, angry, fuck you, zero fuck, rock and roll. He inspired one way or the other, either, you know, through 6 degrees, 3 degrees, 4 degrees, 5 degrees separation, like a whole generation of rock. And he's the guy still alive. And like half of them are fucking dead generations before him. Go watch that thing. It's pretty good. Especially, but see, I can look at Billy Joel. I'm like, well, why is this old guy doing? Like, Billy Joel got a new song out. I'm like, eh, I don't care. I haven't cared about a Billy Joel song in forever. And again, don't care a lot about the new Rolling Stones music. But if Keith does something, I'm like, I'll check it out. Look at that guy. Look at Keith. Look at fucking Keith. I'm going to put my Keith beanie on and play my guitar. Before I forget, I wanted to bring up that my friend, the hilarious Fahim Anwar, He's got a new special out called House Money. It's on his YouTube channel, youtube.com/FahimAnwar. Very funny fella. He's been on here before. But go watch his new special. Now, my guest, as I said, great actor. One of the best, really. The New Look is streaming now on Apple TV+. The first 5 episodes are up now with new episodes every Wednesday. I watched the whole thing. It was great. His movies are great. Ben Mendelsohn is here, and I'm going to talk to him now.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
Seit mehr als 155 Jahren begleitet die Commerzbank Kundinnen und Kunden bei wichtigen finanziellen Entscheidungen. Ob sie ihr Unternehmen weiterentwickeln, ihr Vermögen strukturieren oder ihre finanzielle Zukunft planen. Gemeinsam machen wir aus ihren Ideen, Plänen und Anliegen echte Erfolgsgeschichten. Erfolg, der auf unserer langjährigen Expertise und einer vertrauensvollen Partnerschaft basiert. Erfolgsgeschichten beginnen bei der Commerzbank. Wann sprechen wir über Ihre? Mehr Infos unter commerzbank.de/Erfolgsgeschichten.
First off, let's talk about the truck. So you grew up liking trucks.
So I grew up all over the place, but the most formative time was in the outer suburbs of Melbourne, which is pretty sort of rough and tumble.
I like Melbourne.
Yeah.
It's rough and tumble. You mean like rural wise or people?
No, people wise. People wise. No, I'm talking about the outer suburbs here. Yeah. I mean, you'd take.
What does an outer suburb mean in Australia?
It would be like sort of Lancaster-y vibe or something. You know what I mean? Like way out of.
And tell me. Let me ask you another question. Do you only know Lancaster because you had a shoot there?
Because I shoot there and because I know a couple of people from out that way and whatnot.
Really?
You know, it makes sense. If you want to have access to LA, it's affordable.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
That's sort of the desert though.
It's kind of the desert.
Yeah.
We didn't live out in the desert. It was kind of a lot of bush and stuff.
Sure.
Anyway, muscle cars were, very loved.
How old are you?
I'm 53, 54.
Oh, so you're a little younger than me. But yeah, but like, because I grew up in New Mexico, muscle cars were important. But they were real cars then.
Oh, they were. I mean, I loved them. And I had a Monaro, which is kind of like a Charger.
What is that, an Australian car?
Yeah, it's a really beloved Australian car.
A Monaro?
Yeah, Monaro. There were two. Monaro was made by Holden, which is essentially GM.
Yeah.
And the GT was the Ford muscle car.
Wow, I had no idea that there was Australian cars.
Oh, yeah.
You don't hear about that. You hear about Australian bugs and snakes. You don't hear about Australian cars.
Well, think about Mad Max, mate. That's essentially an apocalyptic movie about running out of gas. Remember in the 70s, that was the whole thing. We were going to run out of gas.
People were filling up tanks, getting online.
Well, and in 20 or 30 years, that was it. We were going to be in trouble, la, la, la. Back to your thing of apocalyptic stuff.
So how old were you when Mad Max came out?
When Mad Max came out was about, 1979? I would have been 10.
So you weren't working yet?
No, but I wasn't. Actually, I wasn't far. It was only another 4 years till I started.
So,
working.
But what was the impact of Mad Max on the Australian youth?
Well, okay, so there's Mad Max 1.
Yes.
But then there's Mad Max 2, which you guys know as the Road Warrior.
Yeah.
Mad Max 2 was phenomenal.
Yeah.
And that's the same period that I'm living out in these outer suburbs.
Right.
And I consider it the most important Australian movie ever made, just because of the impact of
Sure.
That.
Yeah. And it sort of introduced the world to. Australian talent.
Oh yeah, well you had Mel,
crazy, right?
Yeah, no, what a god. God of cinema in general.
Yeah, and that first one, that was like rough. It was like an indie movie.
It was very much. It was the gang and they were driving around and whatnot, and he's there in the cops, and he's got his V8 Interceptor.
And doesn't his wife get killed in
That's
the first
it.
One?
Yeah, yeah. And so it's a Lays great the shot. Groundwork. Yeah, it's yeah. a great shot of that. Him running up and all that. Yeah.
Horrendous.
Yeah.
So do you have you worked with him?
With Mel?
Yeah.
No, I haven't. No, I haven't.
Have you met him?
Yeah, yeah, a bunch of times.
Yeah?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
do you do the Australian thing, whatever that is?
Oh, yeah, you know, I mean, we talk about Australia and stuff like that, but yeah, he's I love him. He made Apocalypto. Come on.
That's some movie.
Oh, mate, it's incredible.
Yeah,
it's
you
incredible.
Like that
one? Oh, it's incredible.
What's the other one? The Passion of the Christ.
Yeah.
Which oddly, even though it is what it is a pretty incredible movie.
Look, he's an incredible talent. Yeah. I mean, like,
Braveheart.
I mean, you know, like, yeah, people get all involved in the Sturm und Drang stuff, but you sit back and think about the body of work, the contribution to the business. It's pretty.
It gets a little dicey, you know, when people's personal reputation starts to overshadow their work. But like with a guy like him, and as a Jew, you're sort of like, I don't know how comfortable I am in general, but nonetheless, I can still appreciate the movies. I can entertain both sides.
Well, and that's this new look thing, which I'm ostensibly here to talk to you about, you know, is something which has a similar kind of people bringing up as a concern and blah blah as well. But
I got to tell you. I've watched six of them.
Oh, okay.
So I'm almost done with it.
Yeah.
And it's stunning.
Thank you.
It's moving, and I don't know, where, because I've seen a lot of your movies. I can't do the whole filmography. I didn't have time.
No, please.
But and maybe I'm wrong, but I think this is one of your great roles. Did you feel that?
I love him more than anyone I've ever played. I had a feeling, about him and stuff. I think he's
about Christian Dior.
Yeah, I think Christian's the I just have a more I adore him, and I can't do him justice, but I can aim for it.
So when you come into something like this, because for me, I didn't know anything about this story about him or Coco Chanel and the framing of it about France, during the occupation and then after the occupation. And I didn't even know that historically, that stuff.
Yeah.
Did you going in?
Well, I knew about the occupation, et cetera, but about the fashion stuff that going on in it, no, never even crossed my mind.
And I don't think I've seen a better depiction of the politics and the nature of collaborating with fascists in such a kind of intimate and almost. The survival element, you sort of understand that people do what they have to do to survive.
Yeah.
But, the difference between, what happened with Christian, is that how you say it? Dior.
You say it however you want to
and
say
And Coco Chanel and how they handled the occupation.
Yeah.
Dior being not a known person.
No, he's just a guy working for Lucien Lalonde. Right?
Yeah, and Chanel being a known person. But the politics and the survival and the sort of business elements of dealing with the Nazis, I'd never seen anything depicted like that. And then Dior's sister, is part of the resistance. I just, as a historical thing, and as a guy who's watched enough Nazi movies, I've never seen this element.
I think Adam's done an extraordinary job of taking the historical record, and these characters, and being curious enough about how people would be in this situation,
sure,
and basically letting us go, go for it. But it's very specific in that way.
Yeah.
But in a more universal way, it just sort of, to me, the hook for Dior was about how he feels about himself in the world versus how he feels about himself privately.
Yeah.
And I think, how you survive, how you can contribute, how you can do the best you can is really the... really the soul of what that's about.
But also playing all that grief.
Oh, yeah. I mean...
Yeah, with his sister.
Well, it's awful. It's an awful situation. And he is, he does everything he can to get her back.
It's crazy, man. It's such a powerful performance. And so it's so controlled. I don't know... And I know, talking about acting, but just as somebody who tries to do it occasionally. And oddly, the first time I ever really you were brought to my attention was by, Lynn Shelton, who was my partner, director, film director. And she passed away, But, you know, she was like all about that Nicole Hoff Center film.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah. Oh, that was, I loved getting to work with Nicole. I mean, that was such an honor to me.
Yeah, that was like...
The Land of Steady Habits.
Yes.
Yes.
It's such an interesting zone of character, that guy.
Yeah, yeah.
But like when you're doing something like Dior, so what is, like, what are the, like, what do you put in your, like, what was the research? I'm just curious for myself. Because you get offered this role and you don't know anything about it. It just comes to you, write a script. Yeah. And then it's like a 10-part thing.
Yeah.
And this is the guy.
Yeah.
So what do you do?
I watch him. I try and see what I can get.
You get footage.
Get footage. Yeah, watch him. That's the most important.
With thing. A historical figure.
With
somebody
with
who's real.
Anyone that you can play that's real, just try watching them. Just to get a sense of them. You get a much more intimate sense of people. I played Rupert Murdoch once, and that was my same sort of thing.
Yeah.
I had an idea of what the story was about, but then I watched him.
Yeah.
And when I watched him, there are things that cut across the ideas that are being put forward in the script. You try to marry them up and do the best you can. So there's this one interview that he did with it's an American TV show.
Yeah.
And Christian's about to open his show in New York or something.
Like in the 80s or something?
No.
Way
Christian
back.
Dior passes away when he's 54.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
I had no idea. Does that happen in the series? No spoilers.
No spoilers. No spoilers.
So the name lived on forever.
Well, thus far, and you know, you go past those stores and this and that, and they don't mean what they, you know.
Well, yeah, that's a whole other thing about post-war France and about the power of fashion and
absolutely,
and the intention of Dior to bring back some sort of vitality and life.
Yeah, he wanted to make the world beautiful again. He really had he was an incredibly principled person. You know, he had all his friends who were designers.
Yeah, yeah.
He didn't want to tread on any of their toes.
Yeah.
What he wanted to do was dress 30 women around the world. But that wasn't going to fly with his backers and
whatnot.
With
the big business, yeah.
So, but he really brought in the economic miracle of post-war France, because the amount of fabrics and stuff that he used in his dresses is one of the really significant drivers of the economic recovery. So he becomes a really, really crucial.
Oh, really?
Figure.
So he was putting out that many, enough dresses
to... Oh, my Lord. He was colossal. In the immediate post-war period, Christian Dior and the couture and whatnot, and the changeover from haute couture to, you know, prêt-à-porter.
What is that changeover? Tell me.
I'm not across it completely, but basically in the old days, very wealthy people would go to a designer and they would get, they would change up 7 times a day.
Yeah.
And these costumes had enormous amounts of fabric and whatnot, but they would change 7 times a day.
Yeah.
So these designers would make that's called haute couture.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, the ready-to-wear stuff, which is what you go into a shop and buy.
Sure, sure, sure.
That's much more mass-produced.
Sure.
So that stuff, the drivers of that, were enormous on the economy.
Oh, wow.
And enormous as well, just on the way the world felt.
Yeah.
You know, and he was really coming from wanting to go back to his childhood and bring back the best times he had. And the only way to connect with his mum was to go out in the garden with her. And, and hang out and garden.
Yeah.
And so all these flowers and stuff and of that period are really deeply imprinted on him.
Yeah.
So he takes those shapes and those things, puts them on, and that's it.
So you're watching old footage of this guy.
Yeah.
And had you done French accent before?
No, I hadn't.
That's crazy. You know what's amazing about this series is that Malkovich reined it in. Like I couldn't believe it, because like anytime I see Malkovich, and I've said this before, and I don't mean it as an insult, but most of the time, if Malkovich is in a movie, there's the movie that he's in, then the movie that he's doing.
Well, I don't share that view, but
no, he's very controlled this time. I mean, sweet.
He's the loveliest guy.
Yeah.
He lives in France a lot of the time.
Yeah.
So his French is impeccable.
Yeah.
He's an absolute genius. He just knows so much.
He's so intense. That's just the sort of I don't mean it as a criticism because I love the guy.
Yeah.
I've seen him on stage. I've seen him do stuff.
I'd love to see him on stage.
I saw him do Burn This in New York.
Oh, wow. When,
and it was crazy because I was a huge fan because I like those kind of guys that were full of that kind of heat. And he can really bring the heat, man.
Oh, he's a powerhouse.
Yeah.
He studied to be a director, right?
Yeah.
And then they obviously did the Steppenwolf thing, et cetera, et cetera. But he is the James Brown of, film and television and theater.
How so?
He's working all the time.
So are you.
No, not like Malkovich. Yeah. I'm like a lazy sort of, well-pampered marshmallow compared to Malkovich. Malkovich is going and working on this, and then he's going here, then he's going there. He does all these things on stage, opera pieces, this, that, the other. He's got the most intense sort of working life of anyone I've ever met.
Yeah.
Our business.
Yeah. I think about that a lot these days. Like when I see people that work that much and they keep working on into their 70s and stuff.
Oy.
But there's part of me that's sort of like, aren't we doing this to stop? I don't know.
I know what you mean. I've been going for 40 years and you spend 40 years on sets and
That's the other thing that I can't quite wrap my brain around in terms of the acting I've done, because I don't live the life of an actor. I do comedy and I do this and I do things that I, but just the idea of all right, we're going to be shooting for 6 months in Siberia. We'll get you a good trailer. That it just really becomes about, the negotiations around trailers.
Oh, look, all of the signifiers of that. I've had my moments with that. And it's truly where the false gods are. But
it's like that is part, that's the whole job, is keeping your shit together in the trailer.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I think actually losing your shit in the trailer and keeping your shit together on when you're shooting is probably a better approach.
It's like that scene in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Did you see that Tarantino movie?
Yeah, where
DiCaprio loses his shit in the trailer.
Yeah,
and freaking shit.
And goes out and does that scene. Awesome. God, it's got such beautiful, beautiful stuff.
It's good stuff about acting.
Yeah.
But it's like, I guess losing your shit, I don't know what it is, but there comes a point with me, and I think I'll learn it as time goes on, where you're waiting for them to set up a shot. And then, obviously you do, how long these things take, at some point you're like, what the fuck are they doing?
Well, I think, you see, because you work with your emotions, right?
Yeah.
And so if you're closing all the taps down, then, it's just sort of all bubbling up inside.
Sure.
So, you talk whatever you need to talk. Like spout here, spout there.
Yeah.
I can't work effectively if I'm not sort of prattling off one way here or there. So it's always...
And
it doesn't matter because at the end of the day, the audience is the alpha and the omega of the exercise.
Okay.
So it really is unimportant unless you are being injurious to people.
Right.
And you can't say sorry or all that sort of stuff.
Right.
Unless you're one of those guys.
Right.
The
ability to apologize properly is important.
Absolutely. If you're because you can forget the effect that you have on other people.
Of course.
We all feel like it's happening to us.
Yes.
And in fact, you can be part of what's happening to them.
Yes.
And once that occurs, you need to be able to go, hey, listen, my bad.
Of course.
And it
of
chills
course.
Everything out. And once people sort of understand each other, they're just like, oh, yeah, he's just.
You're right. That's his process.
Yeah, he's just
that's his process. She's crying, but he'll apologize later.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And that takes time. And then once that's all clicks in, then you're in the ride.
Yeah.
And you you form real attachments with people you work with, and then it's gone.
It's gone.
It's gone.
It took me years doing the show to realize that actors don't hang out with each other after amazing movies.
No, very, very rarely. I mean, we know each other. We sort of adore each other, but it's very rare that you...
You're palling around.
Yeah, very rare.
Isn't that weird?
It is weird, but it's a carnival life. It's a circus life.
I guess And once the show is over,
you form up for the next one.
You go to your real life.
Well, yeah, and
or the
whatever
life
real life you can manage in amongst those hours. And that's part of the part of the thing too.
So you find that being like when you're in your downtime or
I want to do nothing.
Yeah,
when in downtime,
yeah,
absolutely Nothing.
Really? Like literally?
As little as I can. I actually just love being at home. You know, like
here,
there, wherever.
Do you spend time there still?
Sometimes. Yeah, I haven't been back there for not for a bit. I was there last year, but yeah, I haven't been back there. What was it last year? Yeah, last year I was there. No, and I'll probably move from here soon. You know,
where to?
Secret space. Well, just leave all that.
But you've had enough.
I think it's
you can live wherever you want, really. Can't
well,
you?
Well, yeah, I think more or less.
Yeah,
you know, more or less.
Yeah, not too far.
I've been to Mongolia. It's an amazing place, but I wouldn't want to.
have a second home there.
Yeah, I just don't know what the internet connection's like exactly. In a yurt.
So. How do I get a tape? How do I get a video out? Yeah, if they want to see me read for something from Mongolia.
Yeah. It's a bit. It's a long way to Ulaanbaatar. If you want to rock and roll.
That band.
Wow, that band.
Dude.
And they, at that time, they are the absolute the alpha best. And omega. We were listening to Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap.
The best.
TNT, which you guys have as High Voltage.
Yes. And High Voltage is the best.
Well, and TNT's even better because it's the Australian version. It's got a better track list. Whatever.
Does it?
Oh, yeah. It's my favorite of their albums. Then Back in Black, of course, came out.
Yeah, and
which we were all very worried about Back in Black before it came out.
I was worried about it.
Yeah, it was a real concern, and boy, did they come back.
They delivered it because, like, after Highway to Hell, you're like, they're here, man. They've done it.
Yep.
And then he dies.
Yeah.
And then Back in Black. But it was like, it was really a Bon Scott record without Bon Scott.
Yeah, very much. And I mean, look, Brian Johnson just did an incredible job.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And the nods, the gentle nods to Bon, and they're not sentimental in any wet way, but they're very Australianly, appropriate.
Yeah.
But you got to understand, like, for you guys, Highway to Hell, they really arrived. But for us, we had years and years.
Oh,
and
no.
Years
for me, it was probably that first one that we got as High Voltage. And then also Powerage. Those are mine.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, and I still listen to them regularly.
Me too.
You do?
Oh, F yes.
Yeah.
I mean,
you can say
they're so just fundamental. Elemental, Chuck Berry the absolute fundamentals of the rhythm.
Yeah, Angus is the greatest lead guitar player in the world.
I mean, he's...
Did you see him when you were a kid?
I didn't. I really wanted to go. And in fact, Dirty Deeds Done Dirt Cheap was the first album I ever wanted. And I asked my mum and she...
How old?
I would have been 7 or something.
Yeah.
And
she wouldn't do it.
No, she got me Little River Band instead. But I love that album.
I saw them on their first American tour, and I believe...
Hold on. When was this?
When was it? It was like, it was in the 70s. I was in high school.
Oh, my God.
And I believe that the story, and I've told it before, is that my recollection is that they were opening for Journey.
Sounds right.
And sadly, I had gone to see Journey.
Oh.
And I didn't know... They were all right, but I didn't know about the power of AC/DC because they weren't that out yet. And I was right up front, and I watched Bon, and I didn't even know what was happening.
So this is, because the live album, If You Want Blood, right?
Yes.
So it's that kind of period that you're talking about. That, that, I believe, is recorded largely in Glasgow.
It was in Glasgow. And then there's the movie. Did you ever see the movie?
No, I haven't. No. In fact, Warren Ellis, the great,
fiddle player,
guy who works with Nick Cave in 33 before that. He is insane AC/DC fan. Bon Scott.
Yeah.
In fact, I got a bobblehead of Bon Scott that I found, which I'm going to give to Warren.
I found Kate Simon, the photographer. She does pictures, a lot of music pictures. She gave me a shot because I interviewed her of them on their first press tour. It must have been 75. Maybe that's right.
I believe so.
So it's a picture of them that's never been out. I have it. It's kind of an interesting little shot.
Oh,
I'll show it to you after.
Oh, yeah, no, I want to see that.
It's kind of, they were so young.
I want to see that. Do you mind if I take a snap of it?
Just remind me after we're done.
No, don't worry. I'll be reminded.
So were there other, like, what was the music scene? You seem like a music guy. So you're in Australia. Who are you going to see? Do you know Nick Cave?
Huh?
Do you know Nick Cave?
Yeah. I don't know him now. I've met him, and I was around in the same suburbs at the time.
Were you around for birthday party?
No, the birthday party I wasn't around, but I also, Roland I knew as well, and who was a guitar player.
Yeah.
And they were phenomenal. But the thing about Melbourne is, Melbourne doesn't give a fuck about anything except the football.
Yeah.
And so you could be in whatever. They didn't give a fuck about the birthday party and all this stuff at the time.
Yeah.
They didn't, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, in general, they didn't give a fuck.
Yeah.
They care about footy.
Yeah.
Australian rules footy.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anything else you're doing, you can sort of do in your little bubble.
Yeah.
And the city at large is like, yeah, whatever, mate.
Who's yeah.
playing? Well, Carlton and Essendon are playing.
They don't care.
They don't, you know, yeah. And
so it's kind of provincial?
Yeah, but it allows for a certain strength,
yeah,
right? Because
right.
you can just sort of go for it in whatever corner you're doing your thing.
Yeah.
The city at large is, you know, is
yeah.
concentrated on the gladiatorial weekend game.
Yeah.
Are you
a football guy?
I'm a rugby league guy because I moved out of Melbourne and lived in Sydney for a very long time. And then I became a fanatic for a team called the Melbourne Storm.
Yeah.
And that game's not played in Melbourne.
Yeah.
Because
I've been to Melbourne a couple of times and it felt like almost like Boston. It felt kind of,
yeah.
you know, it was, I thought it was very, sophisticated somehow.
Or look, it is.
Good hip people.
Yeah, no, it is. And it was at one moment in time the richest place on earth
because yeah.
the gold rush was going up the road there,
oh, yeah.
which is why it's got that sort of European,
yeah.
you know, high Victorian era feel because
yeah,
that's
yeah.
when it was making like mega
oh,
cash.
Oh, right.
But Melbourne is sort of is distinct from other Australian cities
yeah.
in that it has a sense of Europeanness. But that's in the city and whatnot.
Yeah.
Out in the round and the outer suburbs,
yeah.
it's, you know, people go, won't you? Yeah. And there's
you
no
can
gun. Yeah, well, I just don't want it because I don't want people lifting it and, you know, because there's no guns in Australia.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're walking yeah. down the street and it's
just fists.
You know, yeah, and you're looking at each other and you know, you're trying. You know, it's very much about putting on a front.
Sure.
And Australians are pretty on each other, you know. So.
Yeah.
We give each other a lot of shit, all of the time.
Yeah.
And so you occupy this kind of range of expression.
Sure.
You drift out of there, you're in trouble. But that gives...
Is that how you learn to act?
Yeah. Oh, of course. And I moved around a lot. You have to fit in with wherever you're yeah. going.
In Australia?
No, I lived in Germany. I lived in England.
Why?
I lived in Australia because my dad is my dad's a genius. So, you know, like, so he would go here, he'd go there, and then into the States. I lived in the States.
Really? What,
yeah,
what kind of genius?
He's kind of a medical science genius. Dude's got a Nobel, you know, along with 7 million others.
He's, really?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Nobel Prize, your old man.
Yeah, that's how I roll. But anyway, he was
he doctor?
Yeah, yeah. But he was completely consumed with that. So we were these kind of wild kids that just sort of, you know.
Yeah, I grew up with a doctor, not a Nobel Prize winner, but self-centered.
I'm flossing. Yes, that's it. Self-absorbed. So, yeah. But we were essentially, me and my brother were essentially, you know, just left to our own
sure,
devices.
Sure, sure. Go
and,
build yourselves.
Yeah, exactly. So I would
that's
wander around the city at 8 years old and stuff like this. Crazy shit, which you would just never, you know.
Well, this is a weird question. It's probably too deep for
Don't worry. I'll either dodge it or embrace it.
Well, no, because like I felt that growing up with fairly selfish parents that you left to kind of build your sense of self without the weird fundamental support necessary.
Absolutely.
Is that you kind of like, you know, you have to adapt. And
yeah.
and because you don't have a full sense of yourself, you kind of glom onto people with stronger personalities.
Yeah, and you learn from the screen. I learned a lot from watching. I mean, my attachment to watching movies and stuff. And,
from
and,
early age.
Yeah, from a very early age was to get a sense of, oh, this is how you behave in the world. So John Wayne, Clint Eastwood.
Oh, those were the ones.
Yeah, well, you know.
Jeff Bridges.
Yeah, well, because you're talking about Thunderbolt and Lightfoot.
I
the great forgotten,
that.
You know, the great forgotten, you know.
Thunderbolt and Lightfoot, after he gets the brain injury.
Oh, man, it's so heartbreaking.
It really is.
It's just beautiful. And that great scene where he's ordering the eggs, and, you
yeah.
know, slightly loose
yeah.
and,
yeah,
you
yeah.
know, coming onto the waitress and
yeah.
stuff. And fantastic. What's his name? The big guy, the one who's in Cool Hand
was
Luke.
It George Kennedy?
Thank you.
Yeah,
what,
yeah.
George, what a gift to humanity.
Oh, that guy.
What a gift.
No kidding.
What a gift.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, he was like, because he was a sweet bear.
Yeah.
Yeah, like he could go heavy.
Yeah.
Or he
but
could like
heart of gold. You could feel it in
totally.
Massive. And particularly in Cool Hand Luke. So Cool Hand Luke as well.
Yeah.
Him, you know, any of those things that showed a male, you know, interacting with this hostile
yeah,
situation.
Yeah. It's a journey for, you know, because I was trying to, you know, I'm working on a new show. And I started to think about, you know, the guys I latched onto as father figures
yeah.
in my life.
Yeah.
You know,
who were yours?
Well, I always chose, you know, angry drug addicts.
Okay.
Yeah, but in real life.
Oh, like, you're talking about as an actual human.
Yeah,
well,
yeah.
They're the ones that you're most likely to have access to because they're out in the world. And so, you know, you bump into those guys in suburbia and
sure,
stuff.
And they're like, you know, big personalities.
Yes, big personalities. Like, and
how do you
and
do that?
And they, you know, you're allowed in the circle.
That's right.
You know?
Until you're spit out. And then that's the rough lesson.
And well, fortunately for me, yeah. we would just get moved on before I could get kicked out again.
But like adapting to all these different environments.
Yeah.
Kind of gave you, like, because I don't know, like, how did you start acting?
Well, I took it in school because it was going to be an easy subject.
Like what, in like what we would call high school or what?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What you would call middle school, I guess.
Oh, middle school. Okay.
Yeah, I guess you would call it middle school.
Like, what, you're 13, 14?
I'm 14.
Yeah.
Because I start working at 14. So I do a school play thing. It goes extraordinarily well. Me and a group of buddies did the play.
Yeah.
Then we heard about a local theatre that was literally looking for spear carriers for Royal Hunt of the Sun.
Yeah.
And we just went along and did that.
Yeah.
Then my best friend from the previous school before I went to America says, hey, I read an ad in the paper. They're looking for kids.
Yeah.
I tell my group of buddies, let's all write in. They go, yeah, awesome.
And this is when you were in Melbourne?
Yep. Yeah. And then I finally get a reply and I say, hey, I got my reply. And, you know, did you guys get yours? And they all looked at me and it was that sort of Taylor Swift moment when you arrive at the mall and they're all there and none of them gone.
Yeah.
And then I just went, well, okay, well, I'll just go by myself.
Yeah.
And I went,
found
this place way over the other side of the city
that
I've never been. And, you know,
auditioned?
I got something from that. You know, it was an interview first.
Yeah.
And then an audition, and then I got something from that, got something again, got something
what
again.
What was this? So this was the year my voice broke?
No, this is well before that. Year my voice broke is like, you know, I'd been at work for about three years by that stage.
Was it a TV thing or was it
film? Fully TV.
Oh, okay.
Like I did about 5 TV shows.
As a kid?
As, you know, yeah.
15?
14 to 17, 18. And then The Year My Voice Broke was also going to be a telly movie.
Yeah.
They started shooting it and they went, oh, I think we should change the stock and try and make it a feature.
Yeah. And that was, and how did that do? Would that put you on the map?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
And then you started acting, but that was the only real...
No, I'd been acting for five years.
But the only real training you had was in high school or middle school.
It's on, no, on the job. On the job. I did a 6-month job. It was called the Henderson Kids.
Okay.
Do you know who Kylie Minogue is?
No.
Kylie Minogue is probably...
I know the name.
You know if you hear her. She is the most... she's the greatest pop icon that's ever come out of Australia, right?
Yeah.
And she was on that series. And there were a bunch of us. And we all did this series.
So this is...
6 months. And we're around 15.
Yeah.
So we all, you know...
So this is like the Australian version of like the Mouseketeer or the Disney guy, like Ryan Gosling.
It's an attempt to be a sort of a sophisticated children's miniseries.
Sure.
But the point is, it went on for 6 months. We were shooting on location and stuff. And after once I did that, I did, you know, that because that was a family. That's essentially what it was. It was about having all these people around you. They were having fun. They were drinking. They were partying, et cetera. And I just, I just wanted to do anything I could to be able to stay in that, you know, I didn't want to lose that.
In terms of the feeling of being on set.
Being around and everyone, and it was just like, because otherwise it was teenage wasteland for me. It was just like, there was no people around.
The outskirts of Melbourne.
Well, yeah, and it was lonely and boring, and you know what I mean? It's just like, when you're a teenager, it's...
Rough.
It's vacant. It's a lot of, you know, like there's a lot of time to sort of doing whatever you're going to do.
Yeah.
But going and doing that was awesome. And I wanted to learn so I could stay because I was terrified of not getting another job.
So how does the education unfold? So after that.
I ask people. I ask
you do a bunch. You did a ton of movies.
Yeah, but I would ask people.
Twice a year sometimes.
Yeah, sure. But I would ask people. I would just try and learn what's good, what do you like, and I would watch the movies. That's how I came upon, you know, the classical sort of stuff, Taxi Driver and whatnot. I got the tip about Taxi Driver from a guy on the Henderson Kids.
Sure.
Started watching that 15 on, you know, 15 to 20 or so. I watched that thing probably 70 times.
For that performance?
Just the whole thing. the yeah. whole thing. I just became mesmerized by that film.
Did you? But did you like you find yourself like looking up the method and all that stuff?
Yeah, sure. No, the method was completely like, I mean, that was the absolute orthodoxy at that time, you know? I mean, it was all about it. So you go back, you'd watch your Brandos, you'd watch your Montgomery Cliffs, et cetera, et cetera. You know, your Shelley Winters, Robert Duvall, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And
the naturalism.
Yeah. And you would, you know, you'd read Respect for Acting, that kind of business, you know.
Yeah.
And you just, I tried to learn.
Yeah.
I tried to learn.
So you did do the studying.
I did whatever I could, you know. And in fact, there was a woman on one of the series earlier than that that put me on to Respect for Acting and stuff like that.
That Uta Hagen?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a good book. I should read that book.
Yeah, it's a great book.
And what'd you learn?
Well, the most important thing I learned, the magic what if, and to take it seriously, to treat it as something that was a...
what if?
You know, and I do have a limited knowledge of these things.
But that's all right. But
what if, you know, if you propose, you know it's not a real thing you're doing,
sure,
right? But the key to unlocking it is, okay, we all know this is this, I'm on set, but what if that was real?
Yeah.
How would a person respond, la, la, la?
Yeah.
And that's the basis of, you know, that's the starting lesson from Stanislavski, from his books.
So you locked into that.
So you lock into that, and then you think about, well, what are the limits of that? And what does that draw
in terms of this world that you're in now?
Yeah, or in terms of how you actually do your work.
Yeah.
And in terms of what that creates.
Yeah.
So, I think the thing about the method, et cetera, from my point of view, in my little take, is it can take you an enormous way, but there's a bunch of things it doesn't point towards, you know? And they're really important things, like clowning. Where does clowning take place in there? It doesn't.
Yeah.
And what's that mean? That clowning is not a type of performance?
Yeah.
You know,
did you do some clowning?
No, but when you look at Jim Carrey at his high point, right? When you're talking about Man on the Moon and the Grinch and stuff like that, I considered him to be the absolute pinnacle of who you guys had at that time, or anyone, because he was the only person I could see that could do that and do that and do that.
Yeah.
Okay, and you take a completely different tack. You think about Donald O'Connor in Singing in the Rain.
Yes.
You know, make him laugh, make
right.
him
sing. Yeah.
Who does that? Who can do that skill set anymore?
Yeah, yeah.
It's gone. But that is also fantastic,
entertaining. Best.
So you get from the point of the intensity of the method and the sort of, you know, almost a religious sort of kind of vibe around it.
Sure.
And then you go, okay, great. But there's all this other stuff. And that's all I meant.
So you're thoughtful about it in the sense that, like, because I remember I was in a clowning class we did a clowning experiment where all you get is a nose.
Right.
And then you have to, and you can't talk.
I'd be terrified, mate.
Would you?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. But that would be great. I mean, that's the point. It's a scary job.
It's a scary job, right? You know, even though I do comedy, though, there's something, the vulnerability of clowning in that if you have any insecurity about it, it's going to read as panic and it's going to undermine your funny.
Ah. See?
What?
You've learned shit every day. If you're alive to it, right?
Yeah.
If you want to learn, if you know that you know about this much.
Yeah, I think I just thought of that just now and it's going to be helpful to me.
Well, it's going to be helpful to me too. Because, you know, in fact, when you go into the sort of the red zone, if you like, you know, the speakers are overblowing.
Yeah.
It's always got to do with the anxiety just coming out too loud. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And then being able to see it. And
the fear.
It takes them out.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So do you want to know my favorite moment of sort of saving the world is Sarah Silverman at the Oscars. Right? Mm. I don't know if you remember that.
I'm trying to think.
Okay.
Yeah.
She's bombing. Yeah. She's going on. She doesn't seem to have anything
prepared.
Was
she hosting?
No, she just did spot or something. And she's bombing.
Yes.
It's absolutely dying. It's excruciating. And then she says, or maybe I'm just someone who can get up in front of 1.5 billion people and give it a go because I don't give a F.
Yeah.
And it's just like, yes! It's like this instant, it's like snatching massive victory from the jaws of defeat.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
That, to me, is the heroic sort of thing about performing, is that you've got, there's a fluidity to it, right?
Yeah,
and if you don't get too locked in and think you know what's what, when you don't know what's what, you just strut, what the fuck?
Yeah.
To quote Fatboy Slim, you know, then you've got a chance.
Yeah.
If you're going in there and you got your battle plan and you know, my character would do this, my character would do that. Oh, your character wouldn't say that? Yeah. Oh, that's strange. It's written on the page.
Yeah.
You could say anything you like, motherfucker, but one thing you can be sure of is your character says it.
Yeah.
You see?
It's on the
page. Right there.
Yeah.
Right there. And that's the problem with that's a problem where people take in method, whatnot, and they take it to an extension where they have the authority over the piece.
Yes.
And that's, to me, where things start to get a bit wobbly, and you don't want to be doing that.
You want to honor the script.
You want to be honored the audience.
Yeah.
You want to honor the audience. Yeah. And if it starts to become all about your authority over the whole thing, well, okay, that's great if you're kicking goals each and every fucking time. But if you're not, step off.
Yeah.
Step off.
Now, when you, like I had Joel Edgerton in here.
Joliad?
Yeah.
I've done more jobs with Joliad than anyone else. Joliad, I only know from an iced tea shout out.
Yeah.
He played my brother in a thing, which is essentially we were doing a shootout thing with the cops. He gets killed. That was his first time on.
Which movie was that?
This was called Police Rescue. This is an Australian series, probably in the 90s somewhere.
Yeah.
And I've done like six things with Joel. I mean,
he's another guy.
That's Joel's extraordinary, you know?
Yeah.
And Joel and his brother, they're extraordinary. Yeah, extraordinary.
But when you're working in scenes with somebody, can you feel an escalation where you...
Oh, yeah. You know. When you're hitting a zone, and the worst thing is when you're giving it on the other side, because the real mark of how good someone is in my book, in the real game, is how good they are when it's not on them.
Yeah.
When it's on you, how good they are. So when you watch and someone and you go, oh my God, there they are.
Yeah.
And you can just feel it. Yeah. And it's just like, oh fuck, it's like magic.
Yeah.
Because like the thing is, when you do this job,
the
best bit about it is you see all these people from TV that you know. I'm serious, like it's awesome. You go around and you go, oh my fucking God, there's Larry Dane. Shit like that.
Yeah.
It's still the best thing about it. I still nerd out about it all the time.
I know, it's hard. It's kind of funny.
Yeah.
Because, you've obviously done a million movies, but I did one scene with Robert De Niro.
Oh my God.
And there was one of those, it was very funny, dude. It was in that last Joker movie.
Okay.
Did you see it?
Yeah.
I was the guy, I was his producer, the TV producer.
Oh, fuck you are.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're not going to, oh my God, of course. Yeah. You did a great job in that.
A little scene.
That one little scene in the thing and then the reaction shot after, I don't want to do any spoiler alerts, but there's a very distinctive moment. And then
where
they
look
get
back.
Then they get you at that. No, you fucking murdered it. You murdered, oh my God. That's really, okay.
It's very funny.
I'm fanning out. Because the scene when you're going in there and you're going, no, and you're right, of course.
You are right.
You know what the fuck is, you know what's
Joaquin made a very interesting decision.
Yeah.
And it was a real learning moment for me.
Oh, he's the best, by the way. Top of the heap.
Have you worked with him?
No, but him. There's him, and there's a couple of others that are just in a class of his own.
We did one take in the dressing room, and then Joaquin was talking to us, and then the second take, and I don't know if it was his decision or Todd's, he didn't even acknowledge me at all.
Right, it's all about Bob.
About Bob. And it was just like this, and I'm talking, and he doesn't even know I exist.
And then that's when it goes boom.
It's kind of amazing. And all I know is I've gotten this thing I do. I do a lot of, and I've noticed because I don't act that much, but I do it every time. When we're walking out, after Robert walks out, I go to the door and then I do one of those, I just look back at him. But I'm so aware of it, the look back.
I know what you mean. Look, they are the things you get taught to do again and again. My greatest breakthrough moment with that stuff, there's one shot in a film called Animal Kingdom.
That's a great movie.
Okay.
That was a big movie. That was Joel too, right?
That's Joel too. Yeah, absolutely.
The crime movie.
Yeah.
It's great.
So there's one shot where David has me come out. I'm chasing the lead character,
I'm
going to get him to try and kill him.
Yeah.
And there's one shot he has me run out of a doorway and go this way.
Yeah.
Now, normally you run out of a doorway and you do something in the shot.
Yeah.
I just went, okay, you want me to fucking run out of a doorway?
Yeah.
Okay, here we go. And I just ran straight out the thing, with no sort of
no flourish.
Yeah. And I went, that's it, you know? And he went, yeah, that's it. And I went, oh, fuck yeah. And it was actually a real breakthrough moment, because it was like, listen, fuck all the shot by shot flourish and having to, you know, do everything in every shot. Sure. Just do that. Just run out there and connect that and that. And don't fucking do anything in it except run out the door.
Yeah.
Because what else are you going to do? Go looky, looky, oh my God, you know?
Yeah,
so everyone goes, oh, that was great what you did in that shot.
Yeah.
You know, every fucking time you do it, you don't need to do it.
Yeah, but it's a hard decision to make because, like, I don't quite get that part. Like,
but the fortunate thing, if you start really young, you're not as daunted by the whole machinery.
Yeah, I don't mind it. I don't mind the machinery. But, like, a lot of times, I don't even know which camera is mine. And I imagine as an actor who's done a lot of work, you always know what camera is yours.
Not necessarily, but it's horses for courses. There are times at which if they're doing multi-camera setups, which they tend to do now, you don't worry about stuff. But when you really want to know how to use the camera is when it's coming in. And that's where the real sort of stuff is. That's where I think the ability to connect closely with the audience. Where that takes place.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I got some, I got some tricks and stuff. I've got stuff that I do around that because I think it, it's an audience.
Sure.
If you've worried about the audience only, then a lot of other things aren't important.
Yeah.
So,
So, like, leading up to Animal Kingdom, I mean, was there periods in the life, because, like,
when there was no work and it was shit?
Yeah.
Oh. Yeah, I was in my 30s, I was like, oh, well, it's done. There was a period where it was like...
Because you started so young, right?
Yeah.
So did you feel like you tapped out, like you were a teenage actor?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I sort of just felt like, oh, I'm going to keep going forever and ever. And then you get to that period in your working life where, the classic actor joke, how many actors does it take to change a light bulb?
How many?
100, and there are two versions. One to change the light bulb, and the other 99 say, that should have been me up there, or I could have done that better, right? that was supposed to be me up there kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then I sat around while a lot of other people were doing really well, and then I got the Australian. mate. The Schadenfreude.
So
I had a good decade or two of that.
So you felt that people were.
Oh no, come on! It's not like you feel it. They don't shy about letting you know.
Oh, really? The Australians.
Oh no! Yeah. We're very direct about that stuff. Australians sort of a true socialist communication country. Anyone can talk to anyone at any time, and if you don't respond, that's a very serious insult.
Really?
Oh yeah, very much.
I was there once, and I got sent home because I bombed so badly, and early on in my career. I went back and did well at another time, but
so you were doing the festival. You were doing the comedy festival.
I did Melbourne twice, but years before that, I took a job headlining with this guy, Dave McKenna, who ran the, it was a big room, and there were two rooms in the place.
Okay, it's not the Esplanade, it's not the...
No, this was back in the, it would have been 92 or something.
Okay, so I'm going to figure it's the joint in Fitzroy there. It's on Smith Street
I took a job as a headliner, and I knew that I didn't have the time to do it, but I figured, why not take it? The guy wanted me, so I'd work it out, and I got there, and I just collapsed into myself. Who was hosting? It was so funny, because it was such a traumatic thing. That it wasn't a hostile firing, but I just, I did a week of previews, and then the first night of the show, I bombed bad.
Oh, mate.
No getting out.
Yeah, mate.
And then the owner of the place, or the guy, Dave, he's like, I don't think this is working out. And it was so funny, because, here's what I did. I did the Steve Vizard show.
Yep.
But there was a guest host. And Russell Crowe was the guest for Romper Stomper.
Yep.
So that's when it was.
Yeah.
So he wasn't anybody but this hot actor. And he's talking about preparing for his Nazi role.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's talking about the books he read. And I made a little joke. I said, yep, that sounds like my bookshelf at home. And it just, because no one knew who I was, it just got nothing.
Oh.
In the studio, just sort of like, what?
Oh.
And that was sort of the beginning of the unfolding, the beginning of the spiraling. And then, so I get sent home and I was kind of relieved. And I remember the show so well. And many years later, I knew who the guy who hosted was Greg Fleet.
Yeah, and I used to live with Greg Fleet.
No shit.
That's the comic. Greg Fleet and I were best friends. Like, joined at the hip.
Yeah.
And I learned, Greg Fleet and I worked together, Yes, go ahead.
So, and I ran into him a million years later at the Glasgow, Edinburgh.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was there, and I'm like, oh my God, you're the guy. Do you remember that? And he's like, of course I remember. He gets at home.
Fleety. The mighty Fleety.
The mighty Fleety. What, he's on his ninth life, that guy.
Oh, no. Fleety's awesome. Fleety's
the best.
Fleety's a complete institution of comedy. And he was an actor. That's where we met. I did my first feature film, which is an uber unknown film called The Still Point, where he and I played these kind of friends of this guy who was going out with this deaf girl, who in real life was my girlfriend.
Yeah.
And she had also worked on the Henderson and kids. She was the lead girl in
sure.
that. And that's where we met. And we, we did this scene where Greg Fleet and this other guy called Steve Bastoni, who's also, a complete institution there, were having a fight, And all I did, I was Peter, the surfer. And I just did this. Look, just like a bad tennis. I did a tennis match. Reality,
Just
going one side to the other.
Sure,
just sucked.
Yeah.
Sucked. But Fleety has the most enormous amount of charisma.
Yeah.
And he's written a bunch of books and stuff. And we would sit around, and that's where we would do these improvising to Bob Dylan and whatnot. And,
sure. Oh, really?
He's a huge part of my life. I mean, Fleety's massive. Massive.
Did you do comedy?
I did a thing called Naughty Dad where you come out and you bang someone on the head.
Yeah.
Like,
It was a bit in a sketch game.
Yeah, it was just sort of that, but all those guys at that time. And then, I got to play, there was the Matt and Matts, the two Matts.
Yeah.
There was, I'm blanking. There was Smithy. There was Lovely who did Jackie Gleason.
Oh my God. So you were tapped into the Melbourne comedy scene.
I was peripheral.
Yeah, but you're living with Fleety so you go to the shows, life.
Yeah, all that, And that's the thing. Comics, you guys, you're the most passive aggressive mofos on earth because you sit around comics, you guys never stop. Just joke after joke joke after joke. It's like
it's exhausting.
On and on.
A lot of ball busting.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah,
and so, and I was sort of peripheral, so I sort of ended up getting like, I've moved on.
I
did. That's the thing. You got to know when to hold them, know when to fold them, know when to walk
but
away,
you did, but
know
did,
when to run.
Right,
know?
But you always stayed in the acting zone. You never thought, like, I'm going to be a comic?
No, I didn't have, it's too, you know what I mean? Like, no. I mean, but I had things were going, I was... people liked me as an actor, to whatever degree.
Right, you were coming up.
And I would, I would work and whatnot.
Sure, but...
I'd probably come up and dipped already.
But you said you like, when you went down... Well, that's the thing I noticed about Australia, too, is that there is an attitude of sort of like, we're down here. There is a ceiling...
Oh yeah, that's it. No, you do it. You do a. You know, you're working and you're at a high level. You're a star there, right? And then that's
then they're waiting for you to fall.
Well, they love. I mean, it's a universal game, isn't it? Come on, let's be real. It's all Rome.
Yeah.
It's all Rome.
Is it Rome or is it just a bunch of insecure fucks? Who just, it's, I wish it was as interesting as a gladiator thing but really it's just sort of like it's envy, resentment, and
maybe it's more, Italian nation states or something, but it's all just these little fiefdoms of whatever. And this sort of, that one over there, little cliques, little cliques.
Sure.
Same as it was in Paris Fashion World. They all had their tiny little cliques.
It's all
they
the
stayed
same.
In them.
It's like high school.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's it. You never move, Does it ever move on?
It doesn't. I was dealing with something this morning where something I said was misunderstood by somebody and it was public. And then I had to call that guy and be like, that's not what happened, dude.
Yeah.
what are we doing?
Oh, yeah. No, I know. There's a lot of advancing, statements and embellishing what they mean and what they don't mean.
Et cetera. And now with social media, it's like no one is safe.
Well, yeah. I'm not involved.
Yeah. Good for you.
No, it's just like I.
So who was your general? Like you did you were in a movie with Toni Collette. That was her first movie,
that's
right?
That's right. That's a film called Spotswood. And here it's called The Efficiency Expert.
Yeah.
That's Anthony Hopkins. That's Russell Crowe.
Yeah, yeah.
That's Dan Wiley.
Do you know Russell well?
Not well. No, no. I know.
I want you all to know everybody.
Well, we do all know each other. You know, we do all know each other. But, you know, Crowe's a Kiwi. It's a slightly different vibe. You know what I mean?
Is it? Like, what's the primary difference?
Well, you wouldn't survive that much, you know, that much primacy vibe in Australia.
Yeah, yeah.
But he, you know, he's got a great lesson.
Yeah.
He taught a great lesson.
I can't, like, sometimes when I watch... It's the thing about acting is that the guys like you who are great at it, like you and Russell and Tony, and it's just there is a magic to it. Like, I can't, like, when you watch Gladiator, you know, and you realize that this is just this guy, but somehow or another, through some genetic miracle or charismatic miracle, he can hold that space.
Yeah.
When you're on a set, because that's the weird thing is when you're on a set, you're just a guy. Yeah. And to know that you're holding that space or to and then just to talk naturally. How the fuck do you do that? And you all do it, that you're holding this space. And it's, I mean, some of it's a skill, but a lot of it is just personal magic.
Well, in Australia, it's a very egalitarian society, right? So if you go out onto a set, the crew owns the set.
Right.
The actors don't own the set.
Yeah.
Here, you go out onto a set, it's very clear. The actors kind of, you know, the actors have a much...
You're the ones making the money.
So in Australia, you have to be able to fit in with the bunch and get the vibe and do whatever it is. You got to take your own blip, blip, blip.
Yeah.
And then take your space, you know, clear the space away. And there are different, you know, there are different methods for that. Tony Collette is extraordinary. And Russell's got his way.
Yeah.
And I've got my way. And you just find a way to make it safe
and
enough
Joel,
for yourself.
And Heath.
Heath, beautiful Heath. I mean, my goodness, boy. That, I mean, what extraordinary, what a horrible, horrible loss.
Were you guys friends?
He's younger than me, you know, and whatnot, but you know, I knew him and I just stayed at his place for a bunch of time and whatnot. And, it's just horrible, you know?
Yeah. Terrible. What amazing talent.
Yeah.
Could have done so much more.
Yep. That's,
but there is something about the Australian actors, like Cate Blanchett and Nicole I talked to.
Yeah. Well, I think we get exposed to a lot of English stuff. We get exposed to a lot of American
Eric
stuff.
Eric Bana, is he?
Eric, absolutely. And he comes through comedy.
He does.
Yeah.
Not for that long, but he did, right?
Yeah, I mean, Chopper. Chopper is awesome.
That's a crazy movie.
Chopper is, you know, like, he's incredible in it.
Yeah.
Just incredible in it. Yeah.
But you think it has something to do, because it's sort of one of those mysteries that I've tried to unsolve.
You want to know what it is?
Yeah.
The social gravity over there is heavier.
Yeah.
When you get over here, the social gravity is much lighter. And that's why we can sort of, we do well over here comparatively, because it's like, oh my God, I don't have to answer for everything at every moment to everyone.
Yeah.
Oh, fuck. Because America has a true freedom. I mean, you really are the freest country that I've ever been in.
Yeah.
And it has very different implications, and it has really profound implications for the scope for achievement and success and all that. Whatever all that shit that they were hoping to get, they got it more right, I think, than most other places where there's a more of a limit, you know, an exterior limit kind of vibe.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, you guys have your own kind of stuff around that, but that sense of we are free is really profoundly different. Like, for instance, you guys will sit down and talk about your therapy, your health problems.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, we would never fucking do
it. You just quietly die?
We talk about it in intimate situations.
Sure.
But to talk about it and sitting in a cafe loud and saying, you know, I went to see my therapist the other day. He seems to think I have a problem with autoeroticism. What's that? And to us, it's like, oh my God, shame attack.
Yeah,
we wouldn't, you know, it's like, so... It just has implications.
Sure.
And you can learn a lot, you know, just by doing that stuff.
Yeah.
And we're pre-trained and whatnot. Oh, the other thing is a lot of us come from working class situations.
Sure.
Now, there's not a lot of easy sort of opportunities to do, you know, drama and whatnot.
Right.
If you're just a person somewhere, you know what I mean?
Sure. Now, yeah, but also like there is an indulgence here. That, like, you know, that same character you just did at the coffee shop is, you know, 5 minutes away from being the most annoying person on the planet.
Amen. Amen. But therein lies the magic, you know?
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. The culture of narcissism has its benefits.
Well, yeah, yeah, no. I mean, yeah. Enlightened, well, sure. Or unenlightened self-interest.
So when, like, when you were having these times where you weren't getting work, did you have a, like,
it's happiest times of my life in some way. They really were. They were. I had a girlfriend. I had a dog. We used to walk around. It was actually a really...
But you didn't have a plan B, did you?
No plan B.
Yeah.
No,
so you're kind of like, was there moments where you're like, well, fuck.
No, there was. I had a time limit on it. I'm like, oh, well, I guess I'll just hang out for another 2 years, see what happens.
Yeah.
And then the 2 years came and went. And still, I didn't have a plan. I thought I would give it another. I'll give myself an extension.
Do you feel more, you have job security now? Or is it still
I have a sense that in some way or somehow, you know, I can work, you know.
Was the Batman break a big break?
They've all been huge breaks. Like Batman was a huge break, but Joel Schumacher, when Joel Schumacher hired me,
yeah,
that because Joel traditionally, you know, if Joel Schumacher hired you, you were going to go on to have a career.
Which film was that?
That was Trespass, which is, you know, you don't need to see it necessarily, but that was a really big one for me. Also, Terry Malick used me in a film. So there were little clues, but by the time I got to, Bloodline and then Place Beyond the Pines and then Killing Them Softly.
You were great in Place Beyond
once
the Pines.
I got a sense that there was a 1-2 punch sort of thing going on, things started to feel good. But I look back and realize how tenuous everything is. And,
sure.
You know, it's unbelievable to make it.
I got to watch Place Beyond the Pines again.
Yeah, it's Derek Cianfrance, and I really want to do something with him again.
Kind of a special movie, and I was thinking about it the other day, you know, to watch it again.
He did the most genius thing that I've ever seen a director do, which is,
and he lived in a trailer in that movie.
I lived in a trailer in that movie, but Ryan and I were both playing tough guys, right? Yeah. That was the original thing. So we turned up on set, we did the first day of work, and we were doing this driving scene, and it sucked because you had the two toughest men in the world next to each other.
Yeah.
And we're saying stuff like, yeah, what are you doing, mate? I'm like, shut up, I'll stab you. I'm like, I'll fucking kill you. Yeah. And we're just going back, and it sucked. And Derek then said, listen, I don't really love what I've written with this stuff anyway, and why don't we just flip it around? Why don't we just go, this guy comes from here, he sees this guy. I mean, look at him. He's beautiful. Look, and he's got these face tats and this and that. I mean, why don't you just be a dude that's around there, done crime, does crime, but he sees this guy out riding a bike and he thinks, oh, I like that guy. Maybe you even want to really like that guy.
Yeah.
He said, what do you think about that? And I went, fucking awesome. And so we went back on. And the whole thing flipped. And for a day or two, it was still, I'm going to kill you, I'm going to kill you. And then all of a sudden, I think one day he said, I'll stab you. And I said, no, you won't. And he just started laughing. And then we broke open. And we just were like two kids playing. And that whole magical vibe that goes on in there is because we were having the best time.
Yeah.
It really is one of the best experiences. And it was low budget. It was kind of, you know, scrappy. But it was heaven. It was real, real heaven that time. And it really comes through, you know.
Because Ryan was able to kind of show up and play. Yeah.
Yeah, we felt safe with each other. And we weren't sort of, you know, we weren't trying to compete against each other or outdo each other. Yeah. And we just found a way to sort of goof around. And I love Ryan. And then Ryan was directing a film. He asked me to come and do that.
Yeah.
I went and did that. And that was, you know, that was awesome. And I didn't know much of Ryan's stuff. I knew his rep and whatnot, but I hadn't seen anything of Ryan's.
He's always pretty surprising.
Oh, he's awesome.
Funny. He can be very funny.
Oh, he's got enormous range of, you know, that's the thing. He's probably the most valuable romantic lead, you know, in you know, like incredibly valuable in that role. Right?
Yeah.
But, you know, he's a guy that clearly wants to, you know, be able to show more and do more.
He can clown it up pretty good, that
guy.
Oh,
absolutely. You know,
that was that movie I think I saw that. Baby Teeth. That's a crazy movie.
That's my favorite film of mine that I've ever done, that I've seen.
It's kind of an amazing movie.
Yeah, that's my favorite movie that I've seen.
What was it about?
Because it's got all the Australian virtues. It's got a big heart. It laughs at itself. It cares about its people. It's got an ease about it. It's got a very muscular femininity to it.
Yeah.
And I just I love it. It's, and you know, it's got the greatest one of the greatest power lifting actors anywhere on earth, Essie Davis.
Yeah.
Toby who's playing Moses.
Yeah.
His character is a drug addict. My character's supplying him.
Right.
Because my daughter is in love with him and is only really alive through that.
Yeah.
So it deals with what are pretty black and white circumstances.
Yeah.
With great relativity, which is also an Australian virtue.
Yeah.
And it can sometimes be a real problem, but it's but you know, in essence, Australia seeks to understand rather than condemn. You know, it has a big heart.
Well, that's good. That's not really happening here.
No, that's
much.
Not. That's not necessarily the same here. But what you do have here is real clarity, which, you know, and so it's a trade off.
Yeah.
And you know, there's a good. I don't know if there's a good meeting place, but that's my conception of it anyway.
Yeah, well, we'll see how it all falls out in the next 6 months or so.
Yeah, well, but look, you know, we've been worried, you know, we as the species has been worried about the end for, you know, more than 2,000 years.
Sure.
Well, more.
Yeah. So, well, I think that's good. That's optimistic.
Yeah, I mean, why are we so special that it's happening right now? Every generation, I think, experiences.
Sure, I think I'm like, oddly, I feel like even if it's an atmospheric river here, I'd much rather water than fire.
So, amen.
But I think politically I panic more than I do about the end of the world environment.
Yeah,
especially after watching, you know, the New Look, because, you know, one thing it really explores is how quickly a population can turn against itself.
Absolutely.
And it's terrifying.
And how do you live in that? How do you, and who are you in that?
That's right.
And how can you be in that? And I do love the universality of that.
Yeah.
That's what I think is it's one of its great strengths.
Yeah.
But first and foremost, it entertains and it
totally.
Holds. And that's the alpha.
And it's shot beautifully.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a quality product.
And it was great talking to you, sir.
Lovely to talk to you.
Do you feel good about it?
Yeah, I feel like it's another milestone. You know, things are going well when you turn up here. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's nice.
Well, it is what it is.
I'm glad to be that guy. It's important. Thanks, man.
Yeah, thank you.
That was fun. I like those Australian fellas. The first 5 episodes of The New Look are streaming now on Apple Plus. New episodes premiere on Wednesdays. Hang out for a minute.
Seit mehr als 155 Jahren begleitet die Commerzbank Kundinnen und Kunden bei wichtigen finanziellen Entscheidungen. Ob sie ihr Unternehmen weiterentwickeln, ihr Vermögen strukturieren oder ihre finanzielle Zukunft planen. Gemeinsam machen wir aus ihren Ideen, Plänen und Anliegen echte Erfolgsgeschichten. Erfolg, der auf unserer langjährigen Expertise und einer vertrauensvollen Partnerschaft basiert. Erfolgsgeschichten beginnen bei der Commerzbank. Wann sprechen wir über Ihre? Mehr Infos unter commerzbank.de/erfolgsgeschichten.
Hi, this is Sherelle Dorsey from TED Tech, and this episode is brought to you by Solidigm. The world runs on data, and data relies on storage. But most businesses rarely think about how crucial that storage really is. The truth is, it's no longer just a commodity. With new demands and constraints, especially from AI, the old ways of managing data are holding innovation back. Solid-state storage from Solidigm is changing that. It helps reduce energy use, shrink physical footprints, and accelerate data at the edge, unlocking more from your AI infrastructure. Learn more at whatsthestateofyourstorage.com.
Folks, we've got a special episode for you on Wednesday this week, a show with this year's Oscar nominees who have been on WTF in the past. That's not just the recent talks we've had with people like Mark Ruffalo and Lily Gladstone, but ones with nominees like Jeffrey Wright and Jodie Foster, too.
And I think as a fairly well-adjusted person, even though I'm crazy about certain things, like my computer, I've survived intact by coming up with a scuba mask, you know, for lack of a better word. You know, I have a reed that allows me to breathe.
Right.
And those survival tools are important in order to for somebody to become a whole person.
Right. Yeah. And it's hard. It can take a long time to become a whole person.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not even sure I'm there yet.
Yeah. me neither. I feel that all the time. Like, you know, am I me?
Well, the worst is as you get older, I just start feeling like I start seeing other people that are blowhards or people that are like super selfish and completely self-absorbed. And, you know, and I'm just like, I was like that too. I'm still like that. That's awful. Oh no. No, you're able to really be humble and be humbled by your consciousness.
Right. Well, you know what I stopped doing? It's like, you know, I started embracing the phrase, I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, you know, like if I don't know something, I'm going to say it. You know, as opposed to pretend I know it or kind of, you know, half ask the answer. I'm just like, I don't fucking know.
We'll have that episode for you on Wednesday. And our regular Thursday episode has comedian Rory Scovel. He's back for another talk. Funny special. We'll also have some more Oscar talk in the full Marin bonus episodes this week. Go to the link in the episode description to sign up or go to WTFpod.com and click on WTF Plus. And a reminder before we go, this podcast is hosted by Acast. You'll notice when on the C note pull off on the G chord, there's not an extra beat there. I hit it sometimes.
Monkey and LaFonda, cat angels everywhere.